Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How precious is honey? Believe it or not, that single sweet spoonful you stirred into your last cup of tea required a dozen bees to each visit 2,600 flowers for a total of about 850 miles in flight to and from the hive. And farmers count on bees to pollinate dozens of the food crops in our everyday diets. Those facts alone had Susan Brackney interested, but her passion for bees really took off a few years ago when a thoughtful friend bought her some used beekeeping equipment and she became an amateur apiarist. Susan Brackney earns her living as a nature writer. Her new book is called Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. Susan, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
How do bees make honey?
Well, they collect nectar, just as you said, one flower at a time, and store it up in their honey stomach and add some enzymes into that and then transfer it into a honeycomb cell inside the hive. And then, believe it or not, they all work really hard to create currents of air in the hive and fan the nectar to evaporate some of the liquid out of it so that it gets that thick honey-like texture that we're used to. And when they decide it's ripe, then they cap it over with beeswax and save it for use over the winter.
So you mentioned honey stomach. It was much to the chagrin of my 9-year-old son that honey is not, in fact, bee vomit.
That's true. It is more accurate to say it is bee regurgitation, if you had to say it at all. They technically have two stomachs, but the honey stomach is really just a temporary storage. And it has a one-way valve going from it to the other real stomach. So the honeybee can use that valve to let some of the nectar in if she wants a little snack herself. But otherwise, nothing from her actual stomachs, you know, those contents can't go into the other honey stomach. So lots of people who love to, for the shock factor, love to call honey bee vomit, but it's really not.
So how long does it take? You mentioned the drying process and the sealing over with wax. How long does it take for honey to go from being deposited in the hive as nectar to being ready to eat?
Well, that's a good question, and not one that's really easy to answer, because different flowers have different nectar, and the amount of moisture in those varies. It varies widely. And it also depends on the actual weather. The humidity and all that affects the ripening time, too. So it's a hard one to answer. And somehow, magically, they know when it's ready to be capped.
And is it actually true that once it's really ripe, that it can't go bad?
Yes. Properly cured honey is good pretty much indefinitely. Bacteria can't live in it. Microbes can't live in it. It's the climate, I guess, the pH is such that it's not very hospitable to any kind of creature.
When there's no beekeeper involved, how do bees decide where they're going to make a hive?
Well, they look for cavities, and typically they live in the treetops in dead, hollowed-out trees. They really like those. Of course, unfortunately, I guess some folks have had personal experience that maybe they'll move into your house or your barn or somewhere where they shouldn't be. I have gotten 5 calls already this year for just those kinds of circumstances where bees are in between the rafters of a barn or, you know, just somewhere where they shouldn't be. And I think a lot of the fact that they've run out of places to live and we don't have as much contiguous forested land anymore, so we are sort of having to share our environment with them a little bit more.
And we should say this is a really interesting process. You don't go in there with a blowtorch or some kind of chemical. You've actually moved entire hives and sort of given them a new home.
That's right. Believe it or not, this is going to sound strange, but you can actually buy a bee vacuum. It's a very, very gentle suction. It just barely sucks a bee down this hose and into a safe little screen wire cage. So ostensibly you could, if you had a cavity situation where bees were in the wall or something, and you couldn't just tear the whole place apart to get them out, you could actually use a bee vacuum to get them out. In my case, though, I've had swarms maybe on a low branch of a tree or a bush, and I'm able to just clip off a branch and lower it into a box and then get it home and put it in the hive, and they decide to stay there.
And when you started your first beehive, you actually bought your bees.
Indeed. And believe it or not, they come through the U.S. mail.
Postal workers beware.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, whenever I have a bee shipment, that stuff comes way faster than some of my magazines.
They don't want to hang on to it.
No, they don't seem to. I can see why. I mean, the bees, you can actually see them. They're in this little wooden box with screened sides, kind of like a window screen material. And you can hear them and see them and feel the heat coming off of them. Hmm. And even smell them. They smell kind of sweet. And it's just really something to be holding a big, heavy box of bees.
How is labor divided among bees?
Well, if you are a worker, you're going to be doing pretty much running through every single job there is. And the only kinds of bees that are workers are females. If you're a male bee, you're a drone, and their only job is to mate with the queen. Other than that, they don't really serve much purpose. They do kind of get in the way, and they laze around and eat whatever they like, and they can even go into other bees' hives, and they'll be welcomed anywhere and cared for anywhere, even though they don't really contribute much, which is interesting to me. And then the queen, oh, poor queen, once she has mated, she is just stuck in the hive in perpetuity, laying eggs like a robot. So.
And they don't treat the men well, though, after mating season is over.
Oh, no. This is pretty sad. In the fall, it's called the Massacre of the Drones, and I've watched it. It's just a terrible thing to see. The worker bees will bar the door, essentially saying, sorry, guys, you can't come in. We just don't have the resources to spare. Winter's hard enough as it is. So they don't let the bees in, and these poor drones don't know what's going on, and they freeze to death. And the ones that don't go quietly, I'm afraid they get torn to bits and you know, just summarily carried out, and they all die and without any dignity.
And is it true that they lose their genitalia in the mating process?
It is true. The ones that, I don't know how you want to look at it, if they're unlucky enough to mate with the queen. you even hear, I've not heard this, but one can actually hear an audible pop after they've mated, and the drone loses some of his parts and plummets earthward, and who knows what that must be like.
Why is it that bees die after they sting?
Well, actually, the queen can keep her stinger, but it is very rare that she would have to employ it. But the regular worker bees, stings, they can sting through an exoskeleton, they can sting other insects and still retain their sting. But when they sting a mammal with really tough skin, like when they sting me, their stinger has some barbs on it, kind of like a fish hook, and they get stuck in our thick skin. And essentially, to get away, she has to sort of rip off her back end. And obviously, you know, you can't live without your back end if you're a bee. So she crawls off and dies, unfortunately.
I know that you wear a lot of gear when you're dealing with your bees, but you have been stung multiple times. I wonder how you, after having been stung yesterday, how you get up the guts to go and approach the hive again the following day.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that. When I first started keeping bees, I got stung all the time. And it got so bad that at one point I was sort of afraid of my new hobby, and I didn't want to go out and look at them, and I was just nervous as all get out. But as I got better at it and realized I was making some mistakes and these bees were trying to school me, I realized, I've been doing some things wrong. I can change my habits a little bit. And then the stinging became less and less and less. And I'm happy to say, knock on wood, I rarely get stung now. So that's made it a lot easier. And, you have to remember, they don't want to sting. It's really not in their best interest to do so.
Some people are so afraid of bees when they see one 10 feet away. What motivates an ordinary, non-Africanized honeybee to want to sting a person?
Well, typically, and it's a good point you make about non-Africanized bees, they're quite docile, especially when you encounter a foraging bee. Usually, she'll leave you alone unless you accidentally step on her barefoot or something like that. As long as you don't bother them, they have a job to do, and they're quite focused on collecting pollen and nectar and water and some of the other things they need. So unless you're near their nest, now that's another story entirely. If you are messing with the nest, you are definitely going to attract the interest of guard bees, who are certainly going to do a few reconnaissance flights, and if you don't get out of there pronto, they probably will sting you. So I guess you just need to know your surroundings well and know if you're near a hive, and you have to be really right on it in order to sort of attract their attention in the first place.
So let's talk about these Africanized bees, which some people will call killer bees. These are, in fact, the fault of human manipulation.
Well, sort of. There are many, many different kinds of bees, I have to note, in the continent of Africa. One of those kinds, Apis mellifera scutellata, has this reputation, and it's the one that folks are referring to when they say an Africanized bee. They're extremely aggressive, whereas I could, near one of my own hives, start up a lawnmower or, make a loud noise of some kind, and they don't care. They just go about their business. Do that near an Africanized colony, and you will be in a world of hurt. They're very quick to sting. They're very excitable, and they will come out in larger numbers than the regular European bees will. So they're very different.
Any ideas for what people can do if suddenly they're being chased by a swarm of bees?
Oh, that is a good question. Well, if they're Africanized, run really, really fast and try to get indoors. Mm-hmm. They have actually shown that Africanized bees will chase you just a little bit farther than Europeans will. Europeans will say, okay, I've gotten you away from my nest. Now I can go back to work. And Africanized, they'll just stick with you.
So you just want to stay away from them whenever you can.
If possible, especially little pets and small children, you definitely, there have been bad accidents and deaths, so you have to be really super careful. And the folks who live out west, they know this, they understand this.
Susan Brackney is my guest. She's a nature writer and a beekeeper. Her book is called Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Apiarist and nature writer Susan Brackney is my guest. Her new book is called Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. We'd love for you to call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I guess it was Shakespeare who said, uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. And being the queen bee is not as wonderful as one might imagine. There's a lot of struggle that comes first.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, if you're talking about the little baby queens and what happens, if you have a queen in a hive and she's failing or not working out for some reason, the bees will supersede her. They will make some new queens, usually 10 to 12 at a time, and as they hatch, they fight to the death, and pretty much the last one standing is their new queen. So it's brutal.
So how do they make these queens? Can any larval bee be made into a queen?
Essentially, yes. If you get it at the right stage in its life, pretty much they determine a queen or a drone or a worker. Your destiny is determined by your diet. Depending on what the nurse bees feed these larvae, for instance, a queen would get pretty much nothing but royal jelly, and that flips certain genetic switches, which creates a queen.
And royal jelly is often sold in health food stores and put into face cream and everything. Is it actually good for people?
Well, the jury's still out on that. I don't know that there have been many scientific double-blind studies here in the U.S. Certainly many claims are made. It's the next fountain of youth and all that stuff. I think it's funny. If most people knew where royal jelly comes from, I think they might be too grossed out to put it on their faces. But it's interesting. When you're a young bee, they have certain glands in their heads, and that's where they produce this royal jelly. When you get to be a little bit older, you lose your ability to produce it. So you have to be just at the right age in order to produce this stuff. And it's a mysterious, powerful substance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Waxahachie and speak with Jamie. Hey, Jamie.
Hi there. I'm calling from Waxahachie, and when I was young, I was taught to brew mead, and so I've been updated on the disappearing colony disorder for pretty much as long as it's been going on. I was wondering if your guest could elaborate on that and then tell us what the average person could do to help, and I'll take my response off the air.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you ask what the average person can do, because there is a lot you can do. But first, colony collapse disorder, it is a big deal. It's been affecting a lot of us. Fortunately, I haven't had it in my own apiary, knock on wood, but there are many big commercial beekeepers who've lost almost half their hives, and that's the bad news. The good news is that there's been enough attention put on the problem that research dollars have finally made their way to researchers, and they are making some progress. There's lots of theories as to what's behind colony collapse, and I'm thinking it's probably several things working in tandem. Certainly, they have less habitat and a lot more stress put on them as far as those bees that have to go on the pollinating circuit from Florida all the way down to Texas and back up to the, West Coast. And then back down and all the way back to Florida. There's a lot of wear and tear, and there aren't as many beekeepers as there once were. So those pollination demands are quite high on fewer colonies of bees. So, we're making them work harder than ever before. And certainly they're exposed to pesticides and all kinds of pathogens from stop to stop. So, these are all factors probably working together to cause some of the problem. Now, as far as what you can do to help, though, there's a lot you can do, depending on whether or not you're willing to live with some weeds in your yard, for instance. I always recommend that folks raise the deck on their lawnmower about an inch and allow those dandelions to flower and learn to love them because they're a great source of pollen for honeybees, and that's a really important staple for them. You can also just always try to have something in bloom year-round if it's at all possible. So whether you're planting bulbs that flower really super early in the spring, or you have some plants that are going to flower well into the fall and hang on even into the beginning of winter, that way you've always got something going for the honeybee to eat. And I guess the other thing you could do is try to buy local honey and support your local beekeeper. Those are all some things you could do.
And we should remind people that this isn't really not just about the disappearance of honey, that without bees, 90 crops that we eat and produce in this country would not be pollinated.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they are responsible for the pollination of 90-some things, almonds and lots of different berries and things like that. But some other insects do pollinate, and even some animals and the wind. So let's say, God forbid, the bees disappear tomorrow. That doesn't mean that certain foods would just vanish, but it does mean that we would have a lot more expensive and maybe more scarce produce in the stores.
We have an email here from Rich who asks, how many bees does it take to fill up a honeycomb cell, and how much honey is in a cell?
How many bees does it take to fill in a honeycomb cell? Does that mean, like, to create the honeycomb or to actually fit into a single cell?
I think he means fill it up with honey.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good question. You know, I'm not really sure. I do know that honeybees, when they go get nectar from certain flowers, they do store the honey from, say, the same flower like lavender. They store that in the same section of the hive, which is interesting that they sort of keep different nectar sources separate, and that allows beekeepers to carefully remove certain sections of comb and isolate those floral varieties, which is kind of neat. They certainly do work together and transfer their nectar loads from a bee to bee and into the cell. So I think you would definitely have multiple bees working to fill up single cells. But as far as exact numbers, I don't think I can give you those.
And what they are eating does affect the taste of the honey, is that right?
Well, the nectar source does definitely have a flavor and definitely affect the flavor of the honey. There's some things that folks really don't like, but you know, just as many folks really do like. Particularly, I like wildflower honey, which is much darker and more complex, and you get it towards the fall, end of the year. I like that way better than the spring clover honey, which is okay. It's very light-colored, and it's very sweet and very simple. And I think that's probably the basic honey. When you think of honey, you're probably thinking of spring clover honey. But really, there's so much more variety, and honey in just ranging in color, you wouldn't believe it. Some of it just looks bright orange. Some of it looks black, even. And they all taste different. It's pretty fun to check out what's in your local area.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Susan Brackney is my guest. Let's go to Bill in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hi, yes. My question is, I was hiking this past weekend with my sons in the hill country, and we came across what we thought was a bee swarm, where the bees were literally swarming around the tree. My question was, is this the time of year where you typically see that thing, and what's the safest way to deal with a bee swarm when you find it? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. This is definitely the time. I have already had lots of calls about swarms. There seem to be a lot more this year than there have been in past years. If you saw them in a true swarm, you would see them in like a big ball. They're all clinging together. It could be the size of a basketball or sometimes even bigger. And basically what's happened is they're in between homes, and they're waiting for scout bees to find new locations. They'll come back and sort of talk it over and decide where to go, and then they'll all move off into the, you know, wherever they decided to land. This can take anywhere from a couple of hours to maybe a couple of days. And as long as the swarm is out of the way and isn't going to cause a nuisance, usually you can just leave them be and, you know, watch from a distance and enjoy the spectacle. It's pretty interesting, not something you get to see every day. But know that they are pretty docile when they're in that state, because when they do swarm, the worker bees take about half of the honey that was in their original hive, and they store it in their honey stomach and fly around like this. So they're really full. They almost feel like they've had a big Italian meal, you know, and they're like, oh, really lethargic. So they're not going to be on the defensive. They're just kind of hanging out in limbo. So you're pretty safe. And if they are somewhere where they're in the way, I would say call your nearest beekeeper or your state bee inspector if you don't know who your beekeeper is, and see if they can't come and collect that swarm for you.
What keeps your bees living in the hive that you've provided for them? Is it just the best possible place to live?
Oh, not always. I have actually had my bees swarm, and basically when a hive is really successful and the weather's good, like right now, that's when they will split into two. They'll rear a new queen, and half the hive will take off, and the other half stays behind. And provided that I give my hive enough room and they don't feel cramped, I can help keep those bees where they belong and not in my neighbor's tree.
So you just have to make sure that you're prepared for this.
Pretty much, yes. Mm-hmm. I have to make sure I have enough equipment on hand and that they have everything they need. And provided, you know, usually that works. Sometimes they still swarm anyway, in which case, you know, I have had to collect my own bees and put them in a second hive, and it's a very labor-intensive way to have suddenly made a split hive. There's other ways to do it that are much easier than that.
It's kind of like doubling down in Vegas, I guess. There's
something
risk
like
involved.
That.
All right, let's go next to Diane in Bedford. Hey, Diane.
Hi. Love your show.
Thank
Very
you.
Interesting. I just wanted to make a couple comments, if I could.
Sure.
That with the dandelions is why I originally called. My neighbors all have immaculate yards, and I'm the one with the dandelions in it, and I noticed a few of them kind of looking at me funny, and I said, now, this is the first crop I understand that the girls come to, and they're looking at me, you know, after winter when it's cold. They come out of the hives to eat, and I said, I'm not killing my dandelions, and I noticed I have a real good bunch of honeybees all the time in the yard. They were there when the hawthorn bloomed. I can walk right beside them, and I'm not afraid, so I don't know if that's why they don't sting, but I've noticed quite a few of them in my yard, and I do everything organically. But I just wanted to say the dandelions had made a huge difference.
Well, that's great. Thanks for your call, Diane.
You're welcome.
Is there anything to that idea that, you know, people sometimes people will say a bee can sense that you're afraid, and then it will sting, and that'll trigger some kind of aggression. Is that true?
Well, I think, again, if you're at their nest or at their hive and you are agitated, they're going to see you. They're going to certainly smell you. If you look like a big mammal, like if you wear really dark colors and you're close to an entrance, you're going to get their attention. And, yeah, if you look and smell like a mammal, they're not going to like that. But in the case of the foragers out on those dandelions, and I'm so glad to hear that you allow to thrive. That's fantastic. Just they're out in ones and twos, and you're not near them, and you're not all up in their face. They are not going to bother you.
We have an email from Steve in Dallas who wants to know how the bees make wax to seal the honey.
Oh, that's a really weird process. it's interesting. They have glands in their undersides on their abdomens that that they use to make wax. They get together in a big ball inside the hive, and they have to work their muscles and create a whole bunch of heat in order to soften these wax scales that just appear almost like magic on the undersides of their abdomens. And they'll, you know, peel these off and work them in their mouths, kind of like chewing gum, and then use the softened wax to shape into whatever it is they need, usually just to make a cell wall a little stronger or completely make brand new honeycomb. And brand new beeswax honeycomb is beautiful, by the way. It's like a really creamy white color. And after it's held a lot of honey and pollen and other stuff and served a lot of purposes, it gets kind of yellow, and sometimes if it's really old, it'll get almost brown. But the brand new stuff's really pretty.
And you had to learn how to take this stuff and render it as a new beekeeper, because you don't just pull it out of the hive and make a candle.
Oh, no. You sure don't. Whenever I take off honey, which isn't a lot, but when I do, you have to slice off the wax cappings in order to get at the honey. And those cappings aren't that much each time, but when you add them together, you get a lot of wax. So I was adding my little, you know, every time I took some honey, I'd take those wax cappings and store them in my freezer. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with them. But then, yeah, I melt them down. I boil some water on the stove, and I put the wax bits in some nylon and actually boil the water, and the wax floats to the surface, and it's pretty cool.
Susan Brackney is my guest. She's a nature writer and a beekeeper. Her new book is called Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. We'll come back to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is nature writer and apiarist Susan Brackney. Her book is called Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Rebecca in Highland Village. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, yes, thank you for this show, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question. I noticed Ms. Brackney had said earlier that honey has, like, amazing antibacterial properties, but I am pregnant, and my physician has said that I can't have honey during my pregnancy and that I can't give it to my child for up to 1 year, and I was wondering what it is about honey that I'm not supposed to have it.
Oh, I'm actually glad you brought this up. There is one thing that can live in honey or survive, I guess. It's a type of spore. It's Clostridium botulinum. And it's rare. I mean, you don't always find this in honey, but you can sometimes. And babies and toddlers, you know, under 1 year of age do not have the defenses, aren't able to fight off these the Clostridium botulinum spores. So you have to be really careful about that. And I'm guessing, as far as your pregnancy goes, that it's the same kind of thing. Just want to make sure that the fetus can doesn't have to fend off something like that.
What do we know about honeybees who are gathering nectar from flowers that might have pesticides on them? Does that filter into the honey that they produce?
Well, I will say this, that there have been times when beekeepers use pesticides themselves to get rid of certain kinds of mites, parasitic mites. They're a really bad problem. And you're not supposed to render honey that you've, you know, that would have come in contact with those kinds of pesticides. And I don't see why pesticides out in the world would be any different. Yeah, it is definitely possible that you could be ingesting trace amounts of that stuff, and it's certainly not good for the honeybees either.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next with John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Susan. I have a question about the sting of bees. Bees dig me, and I've been stung multiple times, enough to be allergic to wasp sting, but I've been stung by honeybees, and they don't seem to faze me as much as wasps do. What is the difference?
Well, that's a tricky one. I don't know if I'll be able to speak to that specifically. They all have venom, and, you know, there might just be a difference in the venom of wasps and hornets versus honeybees. And also, your own reaction to stings sometimes can change over time as well. I've heard that beekeepers either become desensitized and they aren't bothered much at all, if they get stung a lot, but then the other, I've heard the other as well, that you can become hypersensitive and even perhaps have to stop keeping bees because your reaction is increasingly bad. So there are a lot of variables, and I'm not really sure how to answer that one.
And bumblebees do not make honey, is that right?
Bumblebees collect nectar and have little pots of it that they sip from. But they do not store, you know, their food over the winter like honeybees do, no.
What does it take for you as a beekeeper to go in and harvest some honey?
Well, I obviously I use my bee smoker when I'm inside the hive to help direct the movements of the bees, sort of get them out of the way of where I'm working. And it also masks their ability to communicate with one another, at least briefly, so they can't say, hey, there's some weird lady poking around, and I think she's going to take some of our honey. So I get in there, and I don't stay too long, and I'll pull out a frame or two and then bring it back inside and slice off those wax cappings. And I have a large stainless steel honey extractor that, you know, has a crank that you turn by hand, and it uses centrifugal force to force the honey out of those cells. Then I'm able to give those frames back to the bees, and then they can fill them up all over again.
So they don't come following you when you take that frame out?
Oh, actually, I always have a few buzzing around the door. It's funny. They know what's going on, I think.
Let's go next to Wendy in Colleyville. Hey, Wendy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a really interesting show. I have a question. Which is better for you as far as your blood sugar, honey or pure cane sugar?
Well, there are folks who say definitely honey because it has some enzymes. It's had some digestion already done to it, whereas processed sugar, you're doing all that digesting yourself. However, the difference between those two, the benefits of having that little bit of digestion that's already taken place aren't necessarily that great.
We have a question here from Brenda who asks, how do you know when a hive needs to be requeened?
I've had hives that needed to be requeened. If the bees don't already do it for you because they know that the queen has been injured or she's missing, you know, something happened to her or she's not performing, they'll replace her. When I've known I needed to replace a queen was when the original queen that I installed has been superseded maybe more than once, and I now have a queen who's pretty wild, just who knows what, you know, she is. She's been kind of created from the wild bees all around in my area, and as a result, she might not be nearly as docile and easy to work with. And so sometimes I've had hives that used to be really friendly and I could work them without any trouble that then eventually became really aggressive. And if it's such a problem that you can't handle it anymore, then beekeepers do choose to requeen in those cases.
It sounds like an unstable republic somewhere.
Kind of, yes.
And you actually ordered a queen, a new queen, through the mail.
Yes. They come through the mail. They come really quickly. And I ordered a really special queen. Remember those parasitic mites I mentioned a little bit earlier? Rather than using chemicals to fight them, scientists have managed to find a genetic trait, a certain kind of behavior that some bees exhibit, called varroa-sensitive hygiene. And essentially, those bees can tell when one of those parasitic mites has infested some of their larval cells. And so they'll uncap a cell, they'll scoop out that bad larva with the mites, little baby mite family in there. They'll scoop that out, they'll start over with a new larva and recap it. They do that all on their own, so you don't have to treat the mites. The bees know there's something wrong, and they fix the problem themselves. And, yeah, you can buy queens that have had, you know, this trait selected for, and the difference is remarkable.
So we've had several questions come through now in email, and people want to know how they can get started doing this themselves. How do you learn to be an apiarist?
Well, I read a whole bunch. There's some really good resources. One in particular that I like is Bee Culture Magazine. They have a website online, and they have most all of their articles archived, and you can look at those for free, which is nice. You would need just the bare bones, equipment-wise. You would need long pants and long sleeves. You could go for a jumpsuit if you wanted. You would definitely need a veil and long gloves and a bee smoker and a hive tool that you use to sort of pry the supers apart from one another. Bees really make things sticky, and sometimes you have to do a lot of prying. You would obviously need a hive and bees, and if you can't find a local beekeeper who sells packages of bees, you can always order them from apiaries. There's some in Georgia and Tennessee. Odds are, though, that you'll be able to find someone locally who can supply you with bees. Yeah, and you just kind of, I flew by the seat of my pants, and, you know, it's not that hard to do.
And how much sort of regular maintenance does the hive need?
That really depends on the time of year. Not so much at all in the winter, although I do choose to feed my bees. I supplement their honey stores just to make sure they make it through. But during the summer and, you know, the height of the nectar flow when lots of flowers are in bloom, you do have to make sure that they have enough room to store that stuff. They can put on 10 pounds of nectar in a single day.
Wow.
If things are really hopping out there. So you've got to make sure you have enough room and make sure that they're not thinking about splitting on you. So, you know, you might pop your head in there once or twice a week during that time. So, yeah, there's definitely a time commitment involved. You can't just leave this thing and forget about it.
Let's go next to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is I have one question concerning, wait, I can't get in my door. Hang on, I'm trying to get to a quieter place. I tried to get rid of my bees the humane way because I heard of a bee shortage.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Well, they've been having lots of trouble lately, and yeah, it's interesting. There have been... it's a little harder to get bees than it used to be. There's a long waiting list now. I didn't even get any last year. I was on a list for some, and that didn't work out. So, yeah, there is a shortage right now, especially since so many apiaries were hit with colony collapse. You can't have half of your hives get wiped out and still be able to create the same number of packages to ship off to the beekeepers all over the place. It just doesn't work. So, yes, definitely, there is a shortage right now.
What do you recommend to people who are sort of, they don't want to hurt the bees, but they're troubled by the proximity? Maybe they're not in a big swarm around the house, but they're kind of freaked out every time they walk outside. Is there any kind of mental exercise you would recommend for people?
Well, I would definitely want to make this point, that a lot of times what you think is a honeybee isn't necessarily a honeybee. A lot of folks mistake yellow jackets for honeybees, and this happens all the time. Yellow jackets are really aggressive, and they give the honeybee a bad name. Yes, they're black and yellow striped, but they're not fuzzy. They're kind of shiny. They live in holes in the ground, usually. They don't collect nectar and pollen and all that stuff. They are going to dive bomb you. You are going to notice them. So I guess I would say make sure that you're blaming the right creature first. If you do have honeybees, again, as long as you're not bothering their nest, unless their nest is like right over your door or something, just remind yourself that you're not messing with their home, that they're flying back and forth foraging, and that's what's on their mind. The one thing, though, if the hive is kind of near the ground, give them a wide berth. It takes them about 5 feet of flying before they reach a little bit over your head. So if you just walk away out in front of the nest, if it's down close to the ground, they'll be able to fly above you without running into you. I guess that's one little trick I would try.
You also include in the book a lot of the different things that you have done with the byproducts of your beekeeping. Can you talk about some of your favorite things to make?
Oh, yes. Well, I really like beeswax soap. I use that all the time. It's got this really pretty yellow color. It didn't always work out, though. Let's just say there was a lot of trial and error involved, because it does involve lye, and that stuff's kind of caustic and dangerous, but fun also, really fun. I make beeswax candles sometime, although those turned out just about as well as the soap when I first got started. When you lit them, they kind of sputter and make little popping noises and then just extinguish themselves. It was really sad. But yeah, there's a lot you can do with that stuff. I've even made, I guess some folks call them life casts or life masks. I call them death masks. Actually cast my face before and made a beeswax mold, and it looks just like me. It's creepy, but fun.
Susan Brackney's new book is called Plan B, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Hardest Working Creatures on the Planet. Susan, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.